Before we get into the presentations, I wanted to mention the NIEHS Worker Training Program, and particularly a new program we have that is relevant to today's webinar. The Worker Training Program is a sister program to the Superfund Research Program, as we are also funded through Superfund dollars. We fund nonprofit health and safety training organizations to provide training for workers who work with or could be exposed to hazardous materials. We have three programs. Our main program, the Hazardous Material Worker Health and Safety Training, is our Superfund program. We have a Department of Energy Worker Training Program and our new Infectious Disease Response Worker Training Program, which may be of interest to this audience. Next slide. The Infectious Disease Response Training Program supports the development and implementation of occupational safety and health and infection control training programs for workers in health care and non-health care settings who may be at risk of exposure to infectious diseases. We are in the first year of a three-year cooperative agreement and are funding 8 grantees along with their consortium members to implement trainings to help keep workers safe from potential infectious disease hazards. Links for more information are provided here, and you can contact me for any further questions. With that, we are ready to start the presentation. First, we will hear from Dr. Philippe Grandjean. Dr. Grandjean is Professor of Environmental Medicine at the University of Southern Denmark and Adjunct Professor of Environmental Health at Harvard School of Public Health. He is a co-founding Editor-in-Chief of the Open Access Journal Environmental Health. He serves as member of the European Environment Agency's Scientific Committee and the World Health Organization's European Advisory Committee on Health Research. His research on children's health and environmental pollutants has been supported mainly by the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences and has led to 300 journal publications. Grandjean's book, Only One Chance and How to Protect the Brains of the Next Generation, was well received and has now been translated into French and Danish. In 2004, he received the Mercury Madness Award from 8 U.S. environmental NGOs. In 2012, the Science Communication Award from the University of Southern Denmark. In 2015, the Bernardino Ramazzini Award, and earlier this year, the John Goldsmith Award. Dr. Grandjean, I will turn it over to you now.
Thank you. Please let me know if you can't hear me.
I
believe that I believe I've been unmuted. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting me to share this research with you, and I also want to thank you because of the generous support from NIEHS to conduct the studies that I'm going to present today. So what I wanted to remind you is that what I'm going to address now is the perfluorinated alcohol substances, PFAS. And those substances have been known for about 60 years. We found that they are highly persistent in the environment, but because of their slight water solubility and some vapor pressure, they have essentially disseminated all over the globe. So we all have PFASs in our blood, in our bodies. They remain there for a very long time because the elimination half-life is quite substantial. And because they pass the placental barrier and they are also eliminated into human milk, we are sharing these exposures with the next generation. So over the years, research has shown various types of effects, and what I'm going to review with you today is immunotoxicity that has emerged as potentially the critical effect upon which we may choose to base our decisions on exposure limits. Carcinogenicity is somewhat controversial at this point, but the evidence available suggests that if we protect ourselves against immunotoxicity, the carcinogenic risk will be very low. Now, in regard to immunotoxicity, there was a recent National Toxicology Program evaluation of two of the most prevalent PFASs, namely the two C8 compounds, PFOS, that is a sulfonic acid, and PFOA, that is a carboxylic acid. Now, NTP concluded that they presumed that the substances would present an immune hazard to humans, simply because there is a high level of evidence from animal studies in both mice and rhesus monkeys, and that there is a moderate level of evidence from studies in humans. Now, the reason that they said moderate level of evidence from studies in humans is that nobody is just exposed to PFAS or PFOA alone. We are all exposed to a mixture of these substances, and in particular, the PFAS and some of the C6 and C9, C10, the other PFASs occur in the food chain. And so if we expose to PFAS, we also expose to several others. PFOA comes generally from a variety of other sources, and therefore it may be possible to sequester out the effects that can be attributed to PFOA rather than the others. But the rest of them will be very hard to separate simply because we are all exposed to a variety of them at the same time. Now, if you look at the animal data, then Dr. DeWitt has summarized them on this slide, and she essentially says, well, for PFOA, the animal data generally suggests that the serum concentrations that are associated with adverse effects are somewhat higher than what humans are exposed to, while PFAS seems to be associated with effects at serum concentrations that are, you know, quite similar to what occurs in human exposures. So to summarize what the background is in regard to the immune system, and this may be simplified from your point of view if you know immunology, but I just wanted to summarize that one of the things that the immune system does is to recognize foreign antigens and then respond to them. And one of the responses is that antibodies are produced. So a review of immunotoxicity sponsored by the World Health Organization several years ago suggested that measurement of antibodies toward vaccines might be a very good way of assessing individual responses to PFAS exposures if they are immunotoxicants. So here is the a summary of what we think are the advantages of looking at vaccine responses. Hopefully the kids are not as scared as this one on the slide, especially when we take the blood samples to measure the antibodies. But the point is that because we have this routine in public health and pediatrics and infectious disease epidemiology of vaccinating children against a range of microbes, then they get the same dose of the antigen at the same age, possibly repeated, and the antibody assay is a routine matter at the hospital laboratories. And they are, of course, highly clinically relevant because if you don't produce the antibodies against the vaccines, you're not protected against the disease. And possibly that deficit in the antibody generation may represent deficits in the immune system as such that could perhaps be an indication of something worse than a mere antibody response to a particular vaccine. And so we were interested in looking at this as a marker of human immunotoxicity. Now, the antibodies that would likely be of greatest interest are the ones that are proteins, so-called toxoids, because they trigger a number of immune responses that then all end up with B cells turning into plasma cells that produce relevant IgG antibodies that are highly specific for the particular antibody or vaccine. So we have been using diphtheria and tetanus vaccines because they're commonly given in essentially most populations, and because there are routine antibody assays widely available, and these proteins simply trigger responses for parts of the immune system that we think are essential to the success of the immune system to protect us against a variety of diseases. Now, having decided that we wanted to look at tetanus and diphtheria, we carried out a pilot study in the Faroe Islands, and we were looking at children exposed to elevated concentrations of PCBs. Some of the PCBs are dioxin-like. We simply measured the most common congeners because the blood samples were not large enough for us to look at dioxins or the dioxin-like PCBs. So based on the marker PCB congeners, we calculated a total serum concentration. And this slide shows you the PCB concentration in the child and its association with the diphtheria antibody concentration at 18 months. Now, that antibody response needs to be above 0.1, which is the criterion for the vaccine having taken. And you can see that some of them are actually pretty low, especially at the highest exposures. The curve here is a generalized additive model, and each of the lines at the horizontal scale represents a single child. That's about 100 total. So this slide illustrates that a PCB exposure that we would think might be immunotoxic is actually associated with a decreased response to a toxoid vaccination, in this case 6 months after the children have received their third diphtheria vaccination. So given that experience, we then carried out an experiment with 12, in this case, adult volunteers whom we vaccinated, and now I show the tetanus antibody concentrations as they changed with time after these adults received a booster vaccination at day zero. So the time is a horizontal scale. And you can see that nothing much happens during the first 5 days, but then the antibody concentration goes straight upwards in most of the subjects and then flattens out. And you can see two arrows on the right. One of them is a woman, one of them is a man, and there is essentially, there's no difference, there's no tendency. The M and W's on the right-hand side indicate who are the women and who are the men. But two of them, those indicated with arrows, are pretty flat, which means that they, you know, against expectation, did not respond to the booster. Now, this is a serious matter, because if they were, let's say, in doubt or in risk of developing a particular disease and the vaccination doesn't take, it could present a serious problem. Anyway, given this study in adults, we embarked on a major study in the Faroes, and I just wanted to show you a picture from, this is from NASA, so it's not one of my own pictures, this one. But the Faroe Islands, as you can see, are located north of Scotland, sort of in between Norway and Iceland. And the Faroes belong to the Kingdom of Denmark. It's an independent nation, and it's a wealthy, homogeneous population. And because everybody knows each other, a total population about 50,000, there is a very high participation rate in population studies. And it's particularly interesting because, especially in the past, the Faroese have been eating a traditional diet in which pilot whale was part. And the pilot whale blubber, which is also eaten to some extent, contains lipophilic contaminants like PCBs, and the meat contains PFASs and mercury. So people who were eating a lot of traditional food, they would then have elevated exposures to these substances. And their neighbors who might not eat as much would have different exposures, and they would otherwise be entirely comparable and similar, so that confounding was not very likely. Pilot whale is distributed freely in the community according to ancient rules. This is something that has been happening for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's the pilot whale is not an endangered species. It's a small whale, and the International Whaling Commission approves of this tradition. Anyway, so here we have a natural experiment, essentially, with children from this highly suitable population, and with a vaccination schedule which is similar to what occurs in other Nordic countries. And I'm now going to show you the a cartoon that illustrates the design of the study. The white vertical bars, the four vertical bars, illustrate the times that the vaccinations are given to the children. The first one is not until 3 months to make sure that the adaptive immune system is ready to respond to the vaccination, probably at a time where there is very little of the maternal antibodies left in the fetal circulation. So you can see within a year there are three vaccinations, and then there's a booster at age 5 to make sure that the child has a long-term protection against the diseases. And this vaccination includes diphtheria and tetanus, and also pertussis and pneumococcus types. So it's sort of a mixed vaccination, but we were looking at tetanus and diphtheria. Our first findings related to the vaccination at age 5 in a cohort of about 600 children, birth cohort, where we have exposure data from birth and also at ages 5 and 7, and we then measured the antibodies before the age 5 vaccination, and actually also right after it, a month after it, and then again at age 7. So the first results were published in JAMA in 2012, and what we saw was a significant inverse association between exposures to PFASs, which at that time were called PFCs, and the antibodies against tetanus and diphtheria. The next slide shows you the GAM, the generalized additive model. In this case, it's the P4 concentration in the serum at age 5. And here we are relating it to the tetanus antibodies 2 years later. So because PFOA stays in the body for several years, the exposure at measured in the serum at age 5 probably represents a time period that goes maybe a couple of years back and a couple of years after the time of blood sampling. And we would also think that the antibodies that are present at age 7 are an indication of immune functions that are the result of maturation of the immune system in childhood. So we think it's quite appropriate if we relate the serum concentration at age 5 to the antibodies at age 7. It was quite similar for diphtheria, slightly weaker for diphtheria. But anyway, this is a representative slide of what we found. I'm now going to show you some numbers that give some more detailed statistics. What I'm showing you here is the odds ratio for a child having an antibody below the clinically protective level of 0.1 international units per mil, in this case at age 7, where we take account of the serum PFAS concentrations at age 5. And here I'm showing you the two major PFASs, namely PFOS and PFOA. And as you can see, the odds ratio for being below the protective limit of 0.5 for tetanus are above 1 for both PFOA and PFOS, and the same is the case for diphtheria. In the bottom, you can see the p-values, and you also have the confidence interval for both tetanus and diphtheria, and for both PFASs, and you can see PFOA is actually highly significant. So PFOA in this calculation showed the strongest effect, and the odds ratios for other PFASs that we measured were below 2. They were in the same direction that we were unable to document that they had an independent effect, because they also associated with PFOS and PFOA. So this clearly indicates that that at age 7, that is 2 years after the booster vaccination, a lot of the kids are already into the non-protective area of vaccine and vaccine antibody concentrations. Let me show you another calculation, and I'll spare you for more tables like this. What we're looking at here is the changes in this, the antibody concentration, changes in terms of percent, that are associated with the doubling of the, in this case, the serum PFOA concentration. The reason we are looking at doublings is that the exposure scale is logarithmic. We simply have a sort of a distribution with some very high exposure levels that we need to bring down toward the others by a transformation to make sure that we have stable models. And so we use the logarithmic transformation, and the regression coefficient that we end up with, we have expressed it in terms of a doubling, so that if it's a logarithmic scale base 2. And we then express the changes in the antibodies, which are also on a log scale. We express the changes in terms of percent change associated with the doubling of the exposure. So if we just look at the regression coefficient that corresponds to the previous curve that I showed you, then tetanus is decreased by about 20% for doubling in exposure, and diphtheria by 25%. And you can see the confidence intervals are quite reasonable. We then conducted a structural equation model where we used both the exposures at age 7 and age 5 and combined them into the exposure latent variable of the structural equation model. And because we now have two estimates of the exposure, we have a better precision of the exposure assessment. And then, as one would expect, the regression is stronger, and you can see they are now highly significant. They're about, both of them are about 35%. Now, what we then did, and that's the bottom one called adjusted, that's for PFOA after we have adjusted the structural equation model for the other PFASs. And now you can see it's about 25 to 30% decrease at a doubled serum PFOA concentration. Now, these are not quite significant, but as you can see, they are at the same, approximately the same level for the regression coefficient, and there's clearly more noise when you add the other exposures to the model. But to me, this indicates that at least PFOA has an independent effect. And since PFOA is the most common water pollutant that we know of, then I think these results are very important for the risk assessment for that contaminant in drinking water. And I want to show you how the PFASs are interrelated in this population. And this scattergram shows you PFAS and PFOA, and I've chosen to show you the serum concentrations at age 5. And it's very clear that there is some correlation, but the correlation coefficient is only 0.5. PFAS correlates much better with other PFASs that apparently occur in marine food along with the PFAS. The next slide shows you the association with PCB, because PCB, as we've already seen, could also result in immunotoxic effects. But fortunately, the PCB occurs in whale blubber and in fatty fish, while PFAS occurs primarily in non-fatty fish and the whale meat rather than the blubber. And so the correlation is quite poor. And when we adjust for the PCB exposure in the models, we don't see any particular impact on the results. So we followed these same kids up to age 13, and I'm here showing you for diphtheria on the left and tetanus on the right, I'm here showing you the correlation between the antibody concentration at age 7 and the one at age 13. And in, you know, every evidence that is available suggests that, yes, the antibody concentrations do decrease with time. And yes, most of them are lower at age 13 than at age 7, but there are several that are higher than they were at age 7. So it turns out that many of them could be explained by a known visit to the emergency room where they most likely got a shot to protect them against tetanus. It's a standard procedure when a kid has stepped on a rusty nail, and you know, the parents take the child to the emergency room. One of the first things is to give this booster vaccination. We could not get complete records of this simply because it's a routine measure that's not included in the hospital chart, and the parents oftentimes did not know. But many of them reported a visit to the emergency room, and so we were able to, these are the triangles on the slide, they were able to say whether that had occurred. But in the paper we just had published by EHP on the website, we showed that it's becoming quite noisy at later ages because of unscheduled booster vaccinations that were not in accordance with our protocol, but which were given by the colleagues at the Tórshavn National Hospital in the Faroes. Anyway, so we went back to our data from ages 5 and 7, and here I'm showing you the diphtheria antibody at age 7 and the in relation to the PFAS, actually PFOA concentration, PFAS concentration at age 5. And the heavy line, the bold line, is an approximation of the association between the two. Both scales are actually the antibody scale. No, they're both linear. I'm sorry. They're both linear. And when we, in accordance with standard procedures for calculating benchmark dose concentrations, we end up with a benchmark dose concentration for the serum levels of about 1 nanogram per mil. And I bet that there's not a single colleague who's listening in today who has a PFAS concentration that's below 1. Maybe there are a few that has a PFOA concentration below 1, but you can see the benchmark dose concentration level is 0.3 for PFOA. And the standard procedure in EPA is to divide that number by 10, because a benchmark concentration is not a threshold, it's a statistical measure. And so these calculations suggest that immunotoxicity occur at such low levels that we must assume that most people today are actually affected by it due to the current levels of exposure. Now, the question is then, but what is the significance of this? So we've already seen that two of the 12 adults did not respond at all to the booster vaccination, and there may be some disadvantages to that, but we haven't documented those. But in the kids, we have recently reported a study where we asked 359 mothers to respond to a text message every 2 weeks whether or not their child had had various symptoms, including fever above 101 degrees Fahrenheit, which means this is definitely an infection. In Denmark and in the Faroes, you don't get heat stress in summer, even the warmest days. So this is definitely an infection in these infants, and we did see strong associations with the PFOA and PFAS concentrations in the mother's serum during early pregnancy. And so it's clear that the more of these substances that the mother had been exposed to, the greater the risk that the child during this whole year that we followed them would have an infection, whether it's a sore throat or some other common infection. So this is certainly something of societal importance and certainly of importance to the families. Now, a previous study carried out in Norway by my colleagues at the National Institute of Public Health in Oslo, they actually showed the same thing in children age 3, where they used the mother's recollection of the child's frequency of common cold and gastroenteritis. So there was a higher concentration at a higher concentration of the PFASs, the child had more frequent infections. So in conclusion, I have to say that the PFASs are apparently immunotoxic at current exposures in human populations. We find that the vaccine antibody concentrations are sensitive indicators of immunotoxicity, but that it's hard to separate effects of individual PFASs, perhaps except for PFOA, in epidemiological studies because they are too closely associated. It also seems that early development is a highly vulnerable stage, even though we see the same effects in adults who actually happen to have accumulated quite high concentrations of these substances. And then it's likely that there are consequences for infectious disease. Now, I just have one little slide left, which I'll show you, namely the transfer of these substances via human milk. The time scale at the bottom goes all the way up to 5 years. And as you can see, there are different ways of getting there. And since we measured the serum concentrations at age 5, then in the studies that I've just reported, we did not have the intermediate concentrations. And this study reported that at longer durations of complete breastfeeding, the children would shoot up in their serum concentrations, particularly of PFAS and PFOA. So we're now examining whether the serum concentrations during infancy show a stronger association with the deficits in immune responses. This is just a brief summary, and again, I want to thank you for letting me participate in this webinar, and of course, my gratitude to NIHS for supporting our work. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Grandjean. I want to remind everyone that you may submit questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right-hand corner. So far, I've had a couple questions come in, so I'll read the first one to you. It says, this is not a critique, just a methods question. I am not sure why confounding is dismissed easily. Diets rich in PUFAs, such as come from fish and whale oil, do they not have the benefits of immune downregulation, along with potential associated effects on immune response to vaccines? Could the difference in immune response reflect differences in exposure to sources?
Right. I think it relates to N-3 fatty acids. Is that what it says?
It doesn't say, but it was asked earlier in the presentation. Does that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. No, it's we've looked at a number of potential confounders. There may be a tiny sex difference. This has been shown in animal studies, but it's certainly much, much less in humans. We've looked at PCBs, and it doesn't change the calculations materially. Breastfeeding is a potentially a very important confounder because breastfeeding seems to promote the development of the adaptive immune system, but at the same time, breastfeeding transfers these compounds to the child. So it's a complicated interaction. We've looked at the fish intake, we've looked at N-3 fatty acids, and we haven't found much of an evidence that there's any particular confounding. It is true that a varied diet, and particularly seafood, must be considered an important part of good health. But unfortunately, some kinds of marine food, particularly the traditional food in the Faroe Islands, including the pilot whale, is not as healthy as it should be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Our next question, in the odds ratios among children who aren't protected by their vaccinations, what group of children were not exposed to PFAS and or PFOA?
Okay, let me go back to here. As you can see, we have some very high odds ratios here. And so it's clear that PFAS and PFOA are the main determinants, the main predictors that the vaccine is not taking. Our subsequent analyses indicate that PFOA is a clear independent predictor, while PFAS is also a predictor, but we can't say for sure if other PFASs are contributing. So I guess my answer is that the jury is still out about the detailed contribution of the individual compounds, but PFOA is emerging as the main contributor to the immunotoxicity that we're seeing. That's the best answer I can give at the present time.
Okay. Let's see. I think we have the time for another question. What is the mechanism by which PFOA and PFOS inhibit immune response?
Yeah, this has been studied by several researchers, and I think various candidates have been proposed. One is the PPAR nuclear receptor, and it's particularly activated by PFOA. The PPAR receptor is particularly important in rodents, but infants express it as well. So, and if PFOA acts via a PPAR receptor, then it's very clear that, I mean, we are seeing statistically significant associations here, but whether they're due to interaction with PPAR, PPAR gamma, or some other receptor is unclear at present. Some colleagues have also looked at the FN kappa B, what is it called? There are other molecules that are crucial for the communication between T cells and B cells, and I personally don't understand the details very well, but those colleagues who do tell me that the jury is still out. We don't know we don't understand the details. And I think that was also clear from the recent report from the National Toxicology Program.
Okay, thank you. And let's do one more. Has the role of epigenetics been studied on PFAS effects on the immune system?
The immune system is dependent on a large number of genes, and so the possibility that there may be, let's say, heterogeneities that are responsible for differences in vulnerability, that possibility is substantial. But because of the number of genes involved and the number of mutations, it's extremely complex. The same response is relevant in regard to epigenetics because we don't really understand the details of how all of these genes interact and the degree of methylation, which ought to be, if it is examined, it ought to be examined in the proper white cell populations. As far as I know, those studies have not been done, but we have studied whether cell populations, white blood cell populations, are associated with exposures to PFASs, and it looks like the postnatal exposure is indeed associated with changes in white blood cell populations. And whether this is then due to epigenetics or some other factors is not known at present.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you very much for your presentation again, and thanks everyone for submitting questions. We will follow up about any unanswered questions, but right now we need to move on to the next speaker. So our next speaker is Stanton. Dr. Stanton is a professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. He is also the director of the Dartmouth Superfund Research Program and the director of the Center for the Environmental Health Sciences at Dartmouth. His laboratory studies the effects of low levels of inorganic and organic levels of arsenic on the innate immune function of the lung. Dr. Stanton received his BS from the University of Maine and his PhD from Yale University. He has co-written and co-edited several textbooks, including Renal Physiology, now in its fifth edition, and Physiology, now in its sixth edition. He was named Andrew C. Vail Professor at Dartmouth in 2010. And Dr. Stanton, I'll turn it over to you now.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking, I can't see the advance button on my screen.
There's some arrows on the lower left under the slide. Do you see those?
There's no.
Bruce, you
oh,
should see them
are.
Now.
I can see them now. Thank All you right. very much. Okay, so I'm going to talk about arsenic effects on the immune system of the lung in response to bacterial infection, in particular Pseudomonas. The outline, I'll talk about sources of arsenic first, then arsenic, an overview of arsenic in known human effects. Then I'll review the innate immune function of a normal lung in response to Pseudomonas infection. And then I'll show data on how arsenic suppresses the innate immune function of epithelial, lung epithelial cells and professional immune cells, in particular macrophages. So the ATSDR list of substances that pose the most threat to public health, you can see here. Arsenic is the number one substance, followed by lead and mercury. Indicated in the bottom part of the slide, you can see that the arsenic is found in water, rice, and mercury is found in tuna. So the sources of arsenic exposure would be, as I just mentioned, it would be in water and apple juice, wine, rice products, including things like Rice Krispies and brown rice. In the U.S., the arsenic exposure, the total arsenic consumption in the U.S. is from water, rice, and rice-based products. It's been estimated to be about 10 to 25 ppb or micrograms per day per person. And this amount is equivalent to drinking about 1 to 2.5 liters of water containing 10 parts per billion of arsenic, which, as most of the listeners know, is the EPA limit for arsenic in water, in public water supplies. In the U.S., this is a map of the U.S. showing arsenic in well water. About 3 million Americans drink well water contaminated with arsenic, that is over 10 ppb. And you can see that there are several regions of the country, for example, the Northeast, where we're located, the yellow and the red are levels above 10 ppb, and the upper Midwest, two different regions in Texas, and the Central Valley of California, for example, have quite a high incidence of arsenic above the EPA level in these private drinking wells. Arsenic in human disease. Well, most of the studies that have been done linking arsenic and human disease are epidemiological studies that are based on relatively high exposures, mostly over in the Bangladesh area of the world. And these epi studies have shown that arsenic exposure results in colds, breast cancer, diabetes. Anyone guess what this one is? IQ? pregnancy, bacterial infections, heart disease, and skin rashes. Some studies that have been done recently looking at lower levels of arsenic. This is studies done by Carol Kim's group at the University of Maine. And she's shown that arsenic enhances both viral and bacterial infections in zebrafish. The top part of this slide shows the effect on the viral titer. So when the zebrafish are infected with the virus and the presence of no arsenic in the swim water, they clear the virus pretty quickly. But as little as 2 parts per billion of arsenic in the water leads to an inability to clear the virus, and in a dose-dependent way, 10 parts per billion leads to a higher viral titer at the end of the experiment, indicating that just very, very low levels of arsenic at or below the EPA standard of 10 lead to an inability to clear virus. In the bottom half of the slide, it's the same, same experiment, but here the fish were exposed to bacteria. And you can see the similar response, that very low levels of arsenic, about 2 parts per billion, lead to an inability to clear the bacteria. This is the presence of no arsenic, 2 parts per billion and 10 parts per billion of arsenic. So you can see that the arsenic in this slide, just to sum it up, has a profound effect to block the ability to clear both viral and bacterial loads from this animal model. A recent study by Rebecca Fry from the University of North Carolina that was just published shows in the U.S. that, or it's a summary of many papers, that prenatal exposure to inorganic arsenic is associated with dysregulated fetal immune gene and protein expression. And then a recent paper from the Dartmouth group, Margaret Karagas's group here, that arsenic enhances lung infections in infants. And she and her colleagues conclude that in utero arsenic exposure increases the risk of infections and respiratory symptoms in the U.S. And these recent studies show that from an epidemiological aspect, that low levels of arsenic do have adverse effects on infections and on the immune response. So the studies that we've done in our lab have examined how low doses of arsenic, that is doses that are more common in the U.S., have an effect on bacterial lung infections. And in particular, we looked at what the mechanism of that effect might be. Just a brief overview of Pseudomonas aeruginosa, or PA as I'll designate it. It's a ubiquitous opportunistic pathogen that's found in burn wounds, urinary tract infections, and lungs in patients with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, and cystic fibrosis, or CF. Importantly, Pseudomonas aeruginosa is really a bad pathogen because it develops drug-resistant biofilms. And the image on the right here is a multicolored image. The gray are human lung epithelial cells. The nuclei of these epithelial cells are stained blue. And then these little green clumps are biofilms of hundreds of bacteria that associate together and become extraordinarily drug-resistant and very hard to treat. And the bacteria readily form these drug-resistant biofilms in the lungs of patients with COPD and CF, also form in burn wounds, UTIs, et cetera. So this is a little bit of a complicated slide, but it's an overview of the innate immune system in the lungs. So what I've shown here in graphical way is these are meant to represent lung epithelial cells. Here are the nuclei, here are cilia, and there's about a dozen or so of the cells. So this would be the airway side of the lung, and the bottom half would be the blood side of these epithelial cells. And one of the functions of this, the epithelial cells have several functions. The first is that they secrete salt and water, and it forms a very thin layer of basically salty water on top of the epithelial cells. And this is mediated by the CFTR chloride channel. And the CFTR stands for cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. Many of you have probably heard of CFTR because it's the ion channel that's mutated in the genetic disease cystic fibrosis. So the CFTR secretes salt and then water follows. And this hydration of the airway is really important for the mucus to be cleared and eliminated from the lungs by the action of these cilia that beat and then sweep the mucus out of the lungs. And this is important because when pathogens like bacteria and viruses enter the lungs, they impact into the mucus layer, and then by the function of the CFTR and mucociliary clearance, these pathogens are eliminated from the lungs where they would have caused damage. The other thing epithelial cells do is they secrete these antimicrobial peptides that then can directly kill the bacteria. And then finally on this slide, what we show is these epithelial cells, in response to pathogen infection, they release a number of cytokines, small molecules like interleukin-8, CXCL1, CXCL2, that then recruit professional immune cells like neutrophils and macrophages. And what these professional immune cells do is when they come into the lungs, they can traverse the epithelial cells and they can directly kill the bacteria. And then finally, in response to viruses, these epithelial cells will produce or present viral antigens, and then professional immune cells come into the lung, and then they kill the cells that are producing the virus and thereby eliminate the virus. So this is just a brief overview of the innate immune function of the lungs. And what my lab does is we study how arsenic affects the ability of these epithelial cells and professional immune cells to clear pathogens like bacteria and viruses from the lungs and the effect of arsenic on that. So this is a data slide that was experiments done by Britton Goodale and Roxana Barnaby in my lab. What it shows is that arsenic reduces chloride secretion by lung epithelial cells. So this is secretion of salt and water, basically, by these epithelial cells that's important for mucociliary transport. And you can see this is in control, not treated at all. And this is chloride secretion in the presence of 5 parts per billion of DMA, that's dimethyl arsenic acid, and this is 10 parts per billion of DMA. So you can see DMA, which is one type of arsenic that's in our blood, can dramatically reduce the ability of these epithelial cells to secrete chloride and thereby eliminate pathogens from the lung. These two bars represent what happens in the presence of 5 and 10 parts per billion of monomethyl arsenic acid. These two, it's just 5 parts per billion of inorganic arsenic. And then the final two bars, it's the presence of 5 parts per billion of a mixture of inorganic arsenic, MMA, and DMA. And you can see, once again, in a dose-dependent way, very small levels of arsenic, and these would represent levels in the blood bathing these epithelial cells, has a profound effect at reducing CFTR-mediated chloride secretion and thereby mucociliary clearance of bacterial and viral particles. This slide shows the effect actually on the CFTR protein. This is a Western blot, and these little blobs here show the amount of CFTR that's been ubiquitinated. And what the cell does when it targets a protein for degradation in the lysosome, it adds a small protein called ubiquitin to the CFTR. And you can see that ubiquitinated CFTR goes up is a function of time after exposure to 10 parts per billion of arsenic. And what happens to ubiquitinated proteins, including ubiquitinated CFTR, is that they get degraded in the garbage can of the cell, the so-called lysosome. And the slide on the right shows how the CFTR over a function of time, 8 hours, here's control and here's 8 hours after exposure to 10 parts per billion of arsenic. You can see that the CFTR protein actually is degraded. If you look in the absence of arsenic, you'd see very little change in the CFTR. It has a very long half-life of about 24 hours. So one of the ways that arsenic gets rid of, reduces chloride secretion is by causing the ubiquitination and the degradation of CFTR in the lysosome. Another thing that arsenic does is it reduces the pseudomonas-stimulated cytokine secretion, in particular IL-8 and CXCL1 secretion by lung epithelial cells. So what I've shown on this slide is the secretion of IL-8, IL-6, CXCL1, and CXCL2. And we'll just focus on this upper left panel A. In the first 3 bars, no PaO1, so that's just the strain of Pseudomonas, in either the presence of 0, 5, or 10 parts per billion. And there isn't very much of a change here. In the presence of no arsenic but Pseudomonas, you see a dramatic increase in IL-8 secretion. And that's important because what IL-8 does, it attracts these professional immune cells, in particular neutrophils, to come into the lung and to kill the bacteria. In the presence of Pseudomonas, 5 parts per billion of inorganic arsenic has a profound inhibitory effect on IL-8 secretion. And it also has a profound inhibitory effect on CXCL1. Here you can see not quite as profound as the effect on IL-8, but it does prevent cytokine secretion. And just to show that it's not this ubiquitous effect, there's no effect on IL-6 or CXCL2. The net result of the reduction in both IL-8 and CXCL1 production is that the epithelial cells will signal fewer neutrophils and macrophages to come into the lungs and to kill the bacteria, which will result in a higher bacterial load and basically more lung disease. We also looked at the effects of arsenic on macrophages. And in particular, we looked at how arsenic affects pseudomonas-stimulated IL-1 beta secretion. So IL-1 beta secretion is very important for macrophages to recruit neutrophils into the lung, which also kill the bacteria. And I present the data in a little bit different way than in the previous slide. And the black here is in the absence of bacteria, and then here is in the presence of Pseudomonas, and then the presence of Pseudomonas with, I think this was 0.5, 5, and 10 parts per billion. And you can see this sort of biphasic effect, a decrease, a pop back up at 5, and then another decrease at 10. The next couple slides just show some other arsenic species. This is MMA, and you can see a very profound reduction at both 0.5, 5, and 10 parts per billion of IL-1 beta secretion. The next slide is DMA, that's dimethyl arsenic acid. That's interesting because it has no statistical effect on cytokine secretion. So just to sum up what I've shown you in the last couple slides is that in response to Pseudomonas, the way Pseudomonas is cleared is you get an increase in mucociliary transport. Sorry, I've just lost my clicker here. Okay, I've lost my arrow. You see a increase in mucociliary clearance in response to Pseudomonas, greater production of antimicrobial peptides. I still don't have it back. Sorry about that. An increase in antigen presentation and an upregulation. Oh, there it is. An upregulation of these cytokines. But as I showed in the last couple slides, arsenic decreases the production of IL-8, CXCL1, IL-1 beta, and it also decreases mucociliary clearance of bacteria by decreasing CFTR chloride and water secretion that decreases the ability to clear these pathogens. So we started doing studies to try to understand and identify the genes that are affected by arsenic. These are studies done by a postdoc in the lab, Britton Goodale. And what she did was she exposed human lung cells from 6 different human donors. She exposed them to either 0, 5, 10, or 50 parts per billion of a mixture of inorganic arsenic, MMA, and DMA for 6 days. And then she did RNA-seq analysis of gene expression, and she also looked at cytokine production by these epithelial cells. And I'm just going to show you a couple data points from this study that is ongoing. And in this slide, we present that arsenic decreases antimicrobial peptide gene expression. So both lysozyme and cysteine-rich secretory protein 3 decreased by about 33 and 46% respectively. And these are important antimicrobial peptides that play a very key role in killing the bacteria that are in the lungs. So arsenic is decreasing the expression of these proteins. This is a really complicated slide. What is meant to do is show that arsenic decreases the antigen-present pathway gene expression. And it's very complicated, but what's important to note is this is most of the genes involved in antigen presentation. And you can see most of them there are green, which indicates that gene expression is going down. The net result of this is that it would be difficult for the cells to present antigen to call in the immune cells that would then clear the viral infection from the lung cells. And Britton is working on identifying more of these genes in the pathway to try to get a better understanding of specifically what genes are downregulated by arsenic exposure in the lung. In the last couple minutes, I just wanted to talk very briefly about some things that we're doing here in the Dartmouth Superfund program on educational outreach activities to reduce exposure to arsenic in the United States with the goal of trying to prevent these adverse effects that arsenic has on inhibiting the immune response to bacterial and viral infection. And what I'll focus on here is an EPA Environmental Educational Grant program that we're working on in collaboration with the Mount Desert Island Biological Lab and Jane Disney, Catherine Lawler, Lori Reardon, and Shannon Rogers are the key players on this program. Jane is at the BioLab in Maine, and the three on the right are associates here at Dartmouth. And that program's goal is to build school and community collaborations to eliminate arsenic from drinking water in Maine and New Hampshire, is to set up and establish a model for other regions in the U.S. that have arsenic in drinking water. This educational grant, we have a website. They've been creating classroom arsenic curricula with a focus on watershed and home well testing, and they've partnered with community folks to expand work on private wells. And the overall goal of this educational program is to encourage and facilitate well water testing for arsenic. As I mentioned, there's a website, What Should You Do If the Well Has Too Much Arsenic in the Water, and there are several community action toolkits and other accessible documents that people can go to determine how to test their well, where to get it tested, and what to do if the well tests positive. So then next to the last slide, there was a recent article, I think this was in the New York Times, Ask Well, Should You Filter Your Water? And I added this statement at the bottom. I think we should, because EPA rules may be too lenient. Some filters reduce lead, pesticides, chlorine, arsenic, antibiotics, and hormones found even in regulated public water supplies. We all know about the Flint, Michigan lead problem. So in response to these outreach projects, we recently just completed a study. We haven't published it yet. I just wanted to show it on the last slide here. And that what we did here was we looked at commercial water filters and their ability to, and these are cheap tabletop water filters. We looked for their ability to remove arsenic from the water. And what we did is we went out, we bought Zero Water filters, Pure, Brita, Home Depot, or Walmart filters, and we added 1,000 parts per billion of arsenic to the water, and then we ran them through the filters. And you can see one filter, the Zero Water filter, took all the arsenic out, even at 1,000 parts per billion. And we've run 100 liters through, and the filter still takes all the arsenic out. Pure, Brita take a little bit out, and the Home Depot and Walmart brand don't really take very much out at all. So this, we think, is an option to doing bottled water or buying really expensive remediation ways to remediate water. These pitchers are pretty inexpensive compared to a big remediation program. And just to sum it up, I just wanted to thank all the people in our group. Pictured here, I've already mentioned many of them. Here's a picture of Britton, Brian Jackson, who runs our ICP mass spec and has measured the water, and then Tom Hampton, who's worked with Britton to do a lot of the bioinformatic analysis of our RNA-seq experiment. So I'll just stop here and thank everybody, and also to acknowledge our research support by our Superfund research program from the NIHS. And I'm happy to stop and take questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Stanton. We've had several questions come in, and just a reminder that you can submit questions using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner now. Our first question is, I work with farm worker families. Arsenic is used commonly in agriculture. Do you know of any studies that have shown higher levels of lung disease in farm workers related to arsenic exposure?
I don't know of any specifically for farm workers.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Let's see. Do you have any ideas on why higher amounts of arsenic have diminished effect on immune function?
Yeah, I mean, so we know from that those RNA, so that's just the gene analysis, the RNA-seq gene analysis studies. And we know that certain genes are downregulated in Most of the studies that have been done seem to point to the immune system. It's the biggest pathway that arsenic seems to downregulate. That being said, I think the specific question is exactly how does that work? I don't think anybody really knows for sure. Josh Hamilton, when he was here at Dartmouth, did some work looking at endocrine disruption, where the arsenic would affect a lot of the steroid hormone and even some of the peptide hormone receptors from activating genes. The subcellular mechanism of that is not known. I think there is some data that suggests there may be some epigenetic effects, some DNA methylation effects that may suppress gene expression.
Okay. Let's see. What level of arsenic intake, for example, what level in drinking water would lead to 5 parts per billion or 10 parts per billion in the blood?
That's a great question. There have been some studies that shows levels around 100 parts per billion in the water do lead to levels that high in humans. But it can be very individual. Not everybody responds the same way. But, my feeling is just to be safe, if there's 10 parts per billion in your drinking water or higher, you definitely would want to filter it, either through that tabletop filter that I mentioned, or if you can afford it, a more substantial, point of entry filter system.
Let's see. And a question about the last slide with the filters. What does the double asterisk mean over the various types of filters?
Sorry about that. Those just mean that they're significantly higher than the zero water.
Okay. Let's see. What is the best method for testing arsenic in people?
I think most of the studies that are done look at it at the arsenic in the urine. It's certainly the least invasive way, but you could also measure it in blood, but probably the urine is the least invasive. The problem, though, with that in any testing is that arsenic is actually cleared quite quickly from the body. If you're exposed to arsenic anywhere from 24 to 48 hours later, it's been cleared or eliminated from the body. So any test that's done just reflects the most recent exposure. Unlike other metals like mercury or lead, for example, arsenic does not accumulate in the body.
You can tell us if this one relates. It says, any relevance of shredded waste tires on synthetic turf fields and or waste tires in landfills? Many states seem not to regulate disposal of whole or recycled waste tires. Is that of relevance to the arsenic discussion?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know actually what's in the waste tires. I know just from what I've read in the New York Times and other papers that stuff is not good for you, but I don't know specifically why.
Okay. And then, let's see, can you comment on the use of residential reverse osmosis systems for removing arsenic from drinking water?
Yeah, it's one of the recommended ways. It can be tricky, and you can't. It's difficult to give a specific answer. I think if you have fairly high levels, say about I think the guidelines are around over 100 parts per billion. That's the preferred way to remove the arsenic, but it depends on what else is in your water, whether you need any pre-filter or additional filtering, or in the cases of high iron level, it can be a little bit tricky to make sure you get all the arsenic out. So it's really a case-by-case issue, and you need to contact a water remediation specialist, or most states have experts in the state who will give you advice. And you can go to our website, the Dartmouth Superfund website, And there's lots of places to click in and get information, at least in New Hampshire and Maine and probably some other more national sites to get into to get that information.
Okay. Thank you. I think if there's we're going to move on to our next speaker. Any unanswered questions we will get back to, or if we have answer some more questions. So thank you very much, Dr. Stanton. So our next speaker is Dr. Syed Hasham. Dr. Hasham is a professor at Michigan State University. His research focuses on environmental molecular biology and mathematical tools to address environmental engineering issues. Current research focuses on gut microbiome toxin host interactions, antimicrobial resistance, and development of point-of-care platforms for parallel detection of microorganisms. Hasham is also interested in developing tools to characterize and manage mixed microbial communities. Hasham received his PhD in environmental engineering and science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and completed his postdoctoral fellowship at Michigan State and Stanford University. Okay, go right ahead, Dr. Hasham.
Okay, thank you. I hope everybody can hear me, just because I unmuted it.
Yes, I can hear you. Yep.
So, all right, okay, thanks. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to contribute to this seminar. As Sarah mentioned, that my presentation will be on toxicant perturbation and instability in the context of the gut microbiome. This is one of the projects that is a part of the Superfund Research Program at Michigan State University. And I have divided my presentation in two parts. First, basic background about the gut microbiome and the objectives, and then some introduction, some very basic introduction about the immune system that is impacted by the compound, the toxicant that our focus is on, TCDD, and some rationale about using two of the gut members. One is segmented filamentous bacteria, and the other one is Bacteroides fragilis. I will present the hypothesis and the experimental details, followed by some results in that. Then the second part is actually much more looking forward to our whatever we are really experiencing in terms of what is not available or what should have been done. So much more like the key challenges ahead in terms of how gut microbiome and host communicate with each other, some of the predictive capabilities in terms of mathematical models, some of the markers that we want to measure, and then how do we measure it, and then at the end what to do with it, the interventions. And then I will summarize the overall study. So as I have listed in this slide, on the left-hand side, you can see there's a long list of diseases. And if I actually mention that the term gut microbiome, actually, the earliest papers I could find with this term is really 2005, 2004, with one or two publications. So it's a very recent way of studying, at least in this manner. And then if you look at the number of diseases like allergy, asthma, anxiety, autism, autoimmune, IBD, obviously, the most recent one that was in the news was migraine. And so these are all caused by, or at least they are finding correlations with the members of the gut microbiome, either with whole groups or with a special or individual members. Those are called pathogens or pathobionts in that. In the same way, you are basically seeing things like the organs that are being impacted. One of the most important ones, or more surprising ones, have been really the brain, that the gut-brain axis that is really becoming part of a number of publications are implying that. And the immune system, which is really the focus that I will have, at least for the data that I'm going to present here. Ultimately, at the end, what we want to do is really some intervention, and some of these intervention terms that you have, you're seeing listed here, you are familiar with, like the fecal transplant of C. diff, psychobiotics is really something like lactobacillus or bifidobacterium addition so that some of the diseases that we are looking at, the gut-brain axis, they could be ameliorated. Effects of the antibiotics and the food habits, etc., those are all well known. But more recent studies are also pointing to very targeted manipulation of the microbiome members like CRISPR and phage-based treatment. So the toxicant I'm going to talk about are the environmental exposure is actually relevant in this context where either intentional or unintentional exposure to one or more toxicants, what it does to the microbiome or to the host, and then how it affects the health of the host. So at a very high level, what we have is really the focus on dioxin. Like I mentioned, that is the focus of our center. And if we look at how dioxin impacts the immune response, especially in terms of two markers, the Treg and Th17, then also look at how segmented filamentous bacteria, that is one of the members that I'm going to tell you more about, and Bacteroides fragilis impact those two immune markers. Then what we wanted to do is really look at how these three things interact with each other, meaning TCDD impacting the immune system, especially the Treg and Th17, the SFB and B fragilis also impacting the same system through some mechanism that we don't know right now. And then how do you actually basically come up with a system or study this where these interactions are much more quantified or at least studied in a manner that is more predictive. So here in this slide, I'm basically representing very basic idea of what actually TCDD does to the two immune markers, Treg and Th17. So on this left side, you see that the naive T cells are really promoted to Treg cells by the TCDD. And on the other hand, these same T cells are really stopped, are basically not eliminated, but minimized in terms of their production to Th17. So that's basically what TCDD does to the two markers. Th17, by the way, it is really the molecule that aids in the antimicrobial response of the host, but if it is too much, then it can also cause inflammation and autoimmune disease. On the other hand, when you look at the Treg, then what it does is basically the opposite of Th17 in terms of the modulation of the response, meaning that it can reduce the autoimmune diseases. So basically, that's what the effect of TCDD is on the T cells. When we look at the members that I'm talking about, I'm basically representing SFB as really a keystone or an important member of the gut microbiome. And it is really one of the very or most fascinating things that I have read in this. So in a 2009 paper from Dan Littman's group at NYU, this was shown that it is actually attached to the ileum in the host, and this is in mice studies, and modulates the immune response in a very clear-cut way, that whole proof, and that's the paper that you can really obtain from the links that I have provided. It is a specific, and its specialty is actually it's very much an obligate symbiont. It does not have any gene for amino acids, vitamins, cofactors, or nucleic acids. So it is an extensive auxotroph, and it's also host-specific. So because it doesn't have all these genes, it was very difficult until maybe last year to culture it outside the host. So it was really basically, you could really propagate it only through the host. But there is one study right now that actually says that it can be grown in TC7 cell lines, which actually may allow much more. It's presence in humans is also something that is of interest because of its role that has been shown in mice. Right now, we can say that these four studies that I have listed, one is really about an IBD patients, about eight patients. The other one in 2000. 13, where about 251 human samples were analyzed. These are the only few studies where SFP-like sequences, especially the 16S sequences by qPCR, have been found. And there's no other information that is available about it, their presence in humans. But its role in the immune system modulation is very clearly shown in that. So what our thought process was that because TCDD actually impacts the T cells and modulates it into either Treg and Th17, and we know that basically this SFB comes in and then says, okay, well, that this Th17 is upregulated compared to the TCDD where it is really downregulated. And if you look at two other members of the gut microbiome that are B. fragilis and Clostridia, then they have a similar effect, similar to TCDD, on the Treg generation. This is B. fragilis, and then this is Clostridia in terms of their impact on the Treg. So basically, you see a very nice system in terms of the T cell and its impact in terms of a toxicant TCDD, which is promoting the Treg cells and then minimizing the production of Th17. And SFB that is promoting the generation of Th17. So what we wanted to do is study is basically how this whole system works in one integrated system where we expose the host to TCDD, and if that host only has SFB or only has B. fragilis in the system or a combination, how this immune system will respond. And then our hypothesis was that whatever is caused by the TCDD in terms of its disruption, that should be basically minimized or eliminated when we have the SFP and the B. fragilis system. So that was basically an interaction of the microbial system with the toxicant on a host and specifically on the Treg Th17 system. So that's what we wanted to test. And so what I'm going to show next in next few slides is really the data. But before we could really test that, what we also wanted to answer is, if is it that TCDD is impacting the gut microbiome first, and then that gut microbiome is impacting the host, or it is the other way around, where TCDD is impacting the host, which then impacts the gut microbiome. And so that study we actually did in a microcosm system, and I'm not showing that data here, but the conclusion from that was that TCDD is impacting the host first, which then impacts the microbiome, rather than TCDD impacting the microbiome member itself. There was absolutely no change, statistically significant change in these members. I'm not showing that anything that we did with SFP here, because at that time when we did the experiment, SFP was not really culturable. It is still not, except the cell lines. So here I'm showing some of the details of the experiment. The main thing that I'm going to present is from this germ-free or notobiotic study, where there are four groups, the germ-free SFP, B. fragilis, and B. fragilis plus SFP, and exposure to TCDD of about 30 micrograms per kg every 4 days for about a month. There are some experiments that we did earlier, and actually it was done in Tim Zakruski's lab by his group, with the traditional mice, C57BL6. So there I'm going to show you some of the data that was related to the abundance of these organisms. And then from this notobiotic study, I have data that is related to the expression of the mRNA, and especially those mRNAs which were related to the immunology genes. So there are about 547 genes on an encounter panel, which is really from a company called NanoString. So that's really a very focused panel of mRNA immunology genes. And then the microRNA expression in the ileum, there is also another panel which is about microRNA from mice. So, and then the measurement of T cells in blood and spleen that was done by Rob Crawford in Norb Kaminsky's lab. So that, those are the data that I will show, and then the overall results you will see in a minute. So this is the first slide where the expression of the mRNA from that panel is shown. On the left panel in here, I'm showing compared to GF, the germ-free, and the red lines here are showing the upregulation of a number of genes from that panel. And this is for SFB, and this whole thing is really with SFB and B fragilis together. And the blue lines are showing downregulation, basically compared to the germ-free. And what is very evident that many of the genes were upregulated when SFB was present in this. On the right side, I have the same basically groups, but now they are exposed to TCDD. And there you see a lot of blue lines, which is showing downregulation of genes. And there you can see two things. One is really that the germ-free and SFB, they have probably very similar number of genes downregulated. SFP has a little bit more. But these two are the groups where the downregulation was more evident than the mixture SFB plus BRB fragilis. So that's the overall result that I'm showing. And now if you go much more specifically into the Treg and Th17 system, which was our original hypothesis, then you see basically on this right panel here where I'm comparing the vehicle to TCDD, and what this is showing that the CD4 plus Treg cells, they are significantly elevated when TCDD is present, that is expected. Some of the genes that are really related either directly or indirectly to these pathways like CD36 here, and then they also are implying in a similar direction, so that means that the TCDD is impacting in terms of Treg, and if you look at some other genes also, it will be very similar in terms of that. But when you look at this effect of colonization, although it is a little bit obvious here in terms of the genes, in terms of the Treg, that turn out to be not as significant or not significant compared to the impact of the TCDD in that. So then when you look at the Th17, there, the story is basically that you have the germ-free mice, and then compared to that, when you apply TCDD, there is a significant reduction. That is what you will expect because of the suppression of TCDD on Th17. But then SFP and SFB plus B fragilis are able to make it up, so work in the opposite manner, and that was basically what we were hoping that should happen. In this case, actually, TCDD as well as colonization, both were significantly different. So that's basically what the conclusion was from this one. And on the left-hand side, I'm showing both the things, basically, that the colonization is impacting as well as there is a decrease because of the TCDD. And that's for one gene and for two other genes, actually. So that's basically what is happening with the Treg and Th17. When we look at the abundance of B fragilis and SFB, this time I have pulled the data where B fragilis is really present in both the groups. Compared to the TCDD, we see a decrease in B fragilis. We see an increase in SFB due to TCDD. So that was really also something that was affected, that was expected. In addition to that, when we actually look at the longer-term studies, basically, that were done with the traditional mice, there the increase in SFB population with those is even more pronounced because they were really done for about 90 days. Like in this case here, we show that vehicle and then smaller doses of TCDD up to 30 micrograms per kg, and that kind of a dose-response relationship is very clear in this. On the right panel here, what I show is that increase over time was observed, as well as during a recovery period from 90 to 120 days, there was also a decrease in the SFP population. That means that it could go back to the normal levels, and both the things are very important. Another thing that is really worth noting is this 0.1 and 0.3, where that increase in the SFB was not significantly different at very low concentrations. So that will be something that I will come back. So that's basically what happens in terms of the TREC TH17, some of the genes that we have followed, and the abundance of SFB and B fragilis. And I would like to then summarize that observation as something that where we applied the TCDD to the system, what is expected that the SFB population should actually go up, because the impact of TCDD on TH17 is opposite of the SFB. And the B fragilis and Clostridia, but I have not really mentioned so much about Clostridia, so I will keep that separate. So B fragilis is going down because the effect of TCDD and B fragilis is additive on the T-reg cells. So that's our basically explanation in terms of why this decrease and increase in B fragilis and SFB is happening in response to TCDD and also the measurement. So that's basically what I think that is very consistent with the hypothesis that we have presented earlier. We also think that the TH17 is something that is responsible for protection against pathogens. So we wanted to see what is happening with respect to the genes that are somewhat related to the pathogens or pathobionts. So here I'm showing that the increase in the antimicrobial resistance genes in these populations in response to TCDD and in somewhat of a dose-dependent manner, but not as much as the SFP. And so there's really more to do here, but since this was very interesting observation, I wanted to add that in addition to whatever we have been talking about SFB and B fragilis. So that's basically the conclusion of first part of my presentation. Then the second part, what I wanted to do is really kind of give you an overview and then say, okay, well, where are the challenges that we are facing and maybe some other research groups are also facing too, is the first question that is, okay, well, who is there whenever we want to study the microbiome? That is quite well and nicely answered in many, many studies, but right now we are much more interested in who is doing what and how they are doing it. There was a question with to Dr. Stanton, and you saw that, okay, well, that is still an ongoing challenge. Prediction, can we actually predict these things to some extent, and can we actually quantify these kind of either dose response or above what concentration this will impact the immune system, and all those questions are important. Then diagnosis, basically, what do you how do you know when something is wrong? And then intervention, how do you actually stop or encourage key members? So the first one I will say that is really done, or it is really much more covered in the second part, where who is doing what and how. That's where this microRNA measurement, I have included that as a proof that in here, what you see on the left side, that SFB and SFB plus B fragilis, when they are present, there's an extreme amount of activity of the microRNA, and compared to the germ-free are only B fragilis. And those things are obviously, microRNAs target a whole lot of different mRNAs, so it's not very easy and simple answer to that. But what is obvious is that there is a whole lot more communication going on when SFB is present in that. And knowing that, I mentioned that Dan Littman's group has really shown very nicely that their SFB are part of the immune development. What I think that if we really had a way of tracking it over time with much smaller amount of blood, then these kind of communications may be much more characterized, or spatial measurement of these things. There are a few studies like this one here from Liu et al., who is basically presenting data where gut microbiota are communicating with the host through microRNA. So those kind of studies will be important. Then comes basically that, how do you quantify things? In here, we are talking about toxicant and perturbation and stability. So if you look at the perturbation, for example, here TCDD, what we want to know is like how much it will be affected in terms of any parameter. So something like here we are showing that a response envelope of a certain parameter will be generated. How do we quantify these things? How do we actually just say that this one is less stable, this one is more stable? And these parameters like resistance and resilience, they have been used a lot in terms of microbial ecology. And when we were studying anaerobic digesters or anaerobic bioreactors, then I presented some of these things. I think that those kind of concepts need to come into the gut microbiome as well, and then basically use it for more predictive tools. And there are some papers coming out, like this model on empty spine that talks about generalized Lotka-Volterra model. Sorry for this spelling mistake. That talks about stability and interactions, and then keystoneness of the populations, but these are very few, and then maybe more disease-specific models may be much more useful. Because these things are not available, I see some of these papers like where gut disruption index would be nice, where we just relate vancomycin resistance, Enterobacteriaceae, and Euphasium, and then basically come up with some kind of a solution for that. So those are the things that are still not done. There are other studies like this one from Gentigi's group focusing on functional genes that is basically saying that maybe butyrate producers should be followed because they are very important players in maintaining the gut health. And their tools like basically FunGene Pipeline and others, they will come out as very important tools because they are designed to focus on primers that are basically on a given function. And the challenge there will be diversity and the coverage of those primers, because these functions like butyrate, kinase, and other things, these are not very small. They have very high allelic variability in their gene sequences. Then once you have the markers, how do you use those markers on a given chip or in a given clinical setting? Right now, everything is going through the high throughput sequencing, but some of the early work that we have done on the smaller hybridization-based assay, like in this one, or amplification-based assays, they could be still useful in the sense that if you have a smaller number of markers, then they could really be used as indicator of gut health. And then the last slide on this is really about how do you actually stop, encourage, or manage. And in this case, what the point I wanted to make is really, if you look at the mathematical models, toxicants, basically everything that I am saying, okay, well, these are really very challenging and not there yet. Out of the 4,000 or 5,000 papers, there are very few that are focusing on these kind of problems, which are more predictive, more interventional. And those things should really be much more upcoming in the future. So with that, I would like to summarize that the TCDD and SFP are B-fragilis interact with the HR in a predictable manner in terms of immune cell response. These kind of interactions may establish the basis for intervention, measuring a smaller effect of toxicants on gut microbiome members through the host may be difficult. And gut member activity like mode of communication and modeling, et cetera, these could be really the future challenges that are yet to be solved. So with that, I would like to basically also leave you with this, request you actually to kind of download this gut microbiome app and provide some feedback to us. This is really the initial version, which we have really put out there just because I wanted to use this opportunity to see what you think and what you would like to have in these kind of information. This is pretty much like for the general audience, not so much coming from the science background, but is still looking at very authentic information in these areas. So that I will appreciate that. And then the last slide is about the acknowledgement. So I would like to thank the NIHS for supporting this work. I would like to thank my co-PIs, Jim Tiji, Tim Zakulski, and NARP, and Gerben, et cetera, for being very, very open in terms of helping me with all the things. And two people I'm showing here, Bob Stutfeld and Maggie Kronlein, Actually, if they were not there, I would not be able to present any one of these things. So they are really great students as well as others in that. So the germ-free study was actually done at University of Michigan with the help of Dr. Catherine Eaton, and then SFP was actually provided by Dr. Tomomi Kohara at Kagawa University under an MTA. So with that, I would like to thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Hashem. Let's see. So if anyone has any questions for Dr. Hashem, please put those questions into the Q&A pod that you see in the lower right corner. I don't have any there yet. Also, if anyone would like to ask any questions over the phone for Dr. Hashem, you can press star 6 to unmute your line and ask a question. Does anyone, I don't see anything coming in. Does anyone have any questions on the phone line?
And just as a clarification, it's pound 6 to unmute.
I'm sorry, pound 6
and star 6 to mute.
Thank you, star 6 to mute. So yes, pound 6 to unmute. Well, I think what I'll do, I have a couple of unanswered questions that we could take from previous presentations while we see if any other questions come in for Dr. Hashem. Dr. Grangine, are you still on the phone? If you could unmute your line if you are, that would be pound 6. How about is someone there? Dr. Stanton, are you on the phone?
Early.
I am.
Okay, great. There was one more follow-up question that came in. Let me just bring it up here. Someone had asked the question that you did answer about higher amounts of arsenic that have diminished effect on immune functions, and then the person had a follow-up question. They said, the answer to my first question is helpful, but what I meant is why is higher arsenic, e.g. 10 parts per billion, sometimes have less harmful than, for example, 5 parts per billion?
So I assume that's in reference to one of the data slides that I showed where the low dose had an inhibitory effect, the medium dose came back up, and then the higher dose went down. I believe that was the MMA effect on the macrophages. Yeah, that's several people, including some of, again, one of our Superfund investigators, Josh Hamilton, in his work in endocrine disruption, has shown that sort of biphasic concentration-dependent effect. And it could be that there are different mechanisms at different doses. At one low dose, say the 0.5 ppb, perhaps it was, and we don't know the answer specifically, but I'm speculating a bit, that at the low dose, the really low dose, it was working via one mechanism to suppress the IL-1 beta response. And then at the intermediate dose, no effect because maybe two effects were canceling out, and then the higher dose possibly working on a different mechanism. That's not uncommon when you're looking at certain toxicants, but unfortunately, I probably don't have a very satisfying answer to the specific mechanism. We just don't know yet. We're looking at that.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Hashem, I do have a couple questions for you here. Could there be other microbes that play the role of SFB?
Actually, that's the very question when we say that, okay, well, we don't know if SFBs or SFB is present in humans. Then the question becomes, okay, well, if they are not, but there should be someone that is SFB-like with a similar role that should be present, but SFB are present in the ileum, so, and then they are present in the early stages of the life, so that means that between 2 and 3 years for human beings. So, and then high-throughput sequencing also tends to miss that because of the primer design approach. So basically, we really think that there should be something that is SFB-like or even SFB, but in humans, it has not been really studied with that focus in mind.
Okay. And then I have a clarification on, I believe, the app. It says, could Dr. Hashem explain what he would like people to download related to gut microbiome on Google Play.
The gut microbiome app itself, and then it has a number of functions that I'm showing here in terms of basically, like say, it has gut members, so it's talking about, okay, well, what are the microbes that are identified, are groups, then dynamics and gut and immunity, how they are related. So this is basically providing very basic information about gut microbiome and human health. And there's really nothing that is very interactive yet there, but that's what we are going to do in the future. And anything else that if somebody downloads the gut microbiome. So the gut microbiome is the name of an app also that is available on Play Store, and it will be available on the App Store, the Mac, within this week.
Thank you. I have a question here on arsenic, so I'm guessing that's for Dr. Stanton. It says, some human populations, for example, high Andes, can excrete arsenic better than most. Are there some populations that have no evolutionary experience with arsenic until wells dug for water and therefore are more sensitive than other populations?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the questioner is referring to a statement, and I believe it was Alan Smith's group, that there's a polymorphism in a gene that metabolizes arsenic. And the suggestion or the data show that this population has, over time, accumulated a polymorphism in a gene that better clears the arsenic. It's the only one I know of specifically. I think that was the first demonstration, and that's the questioner asked. I think it was the high Andes population.
Okay, so I have no more questions here. I'm going to do some closing comments, and if we have time, if there's anything else at the very end, we can answer any more. But before we conclude, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the Related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also, in the Related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page, follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, join the Cleanup Information Network CLUIN LinkedIn group, visit the SRP Risk e-learning webpage, and follow SRP NIEHS on Twitter. I'd also like to encourage you to join us next week for the third session of the series on Monday, November 7th at 1 p.m. Eastern. This session will focus on interactions between environmental exposures and infectious agents in the lung. Dr. Steven Kleberger will describe his work to understand the mechanisms of respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, infection, and disease severity, and how that relates to exposure to environmental insults. Dr. Fena Soleil will discuss how early life exposure to arsenic permanently changes the immune system and increases infectious disease risk later in life, using Mycobacterium tuberculosis in the lung as the model. Dr. Steph Cormier will discuss the relationship between environmentally persistent free radicals, EPFRs, and severity of respiratory viral infections. I think we could probably take one more question here. I had something else come in for Dr. Hasham. Let's see. It says, where'd it go? Dr. Hasham, how realistic are the TCDD concentration used in the study? Microgram concentration of TCDD per kilogram seems to me rather high. If you could answer that somewhat quickly, that would be great.
Yes. So like I mentioned there, the lower concentrations were included to be actually closer to the realistic doses, but the higher doses, it's basically the same dose-response relationship when you want to study, and that too in a short time, you want to see the effect by increasing the dosage. So these are not as realistic as we would like to be, but these were the concentrations used within the constraints of the study, meaning time and basically being able to measure the effect. But like I mentioned, that the lower concentrations, 0.1, 0.3, yes, they will not be able to show, and that is really one of the major problems with toxicants, that at very low dosages, you may have to actually do these studies in a very different way to be able to see.
Let's see, we have one more quick question I think we have time for. Do the geographically dispersed arsenic-exposed populations have anything in common in gut microbiome? Is that...
Who's that question for?
You know, it does not specify. So it kind of ties in the two topics. So if neither of you are able to answer on the phone, that's fine. We can follow up with them later. So yeah, I think what we'll do is we'll wrap out.
Yeah. I mean, there seems to be some connection. Basically, we are talking about the same, like the IL-6, IL-1B immune system. So that much, and that's basically where my knowledge of the arsenic and immune system response ends. But it is definitely something that is worth looking into.
Great, thank you. Yes, it was for you, Dr. Shah. Okay, so if you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, we will respond via email. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Our email addresses are on the seminar homepage on Cluin. I would like to thank our presenters, Philippe Grandjean, Bruce Stanton, and Syed Hasham, for their time preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation, everyone.